This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss the Israel-Palestine peace talks.
These have been going on for 22 years, on and off. Is this one for real?
Marie Mason is serving a 22-year prison sentence for actions related to environmental activism.
The government made an example out of her for protesting in the wrong way, the clear cutting of old-growth forests and genetically modified seeds.
We'll also hear a presentation from Dr. Harriet Fraud at the Left Forum in New York City.
She's a practicing psychotherapist, and she talks about what life would be like in this country if we didn't have a capitalist system.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, congratulations on your new book, Spying on Democracy. What a great title, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. It just came out. It's got a fabulous cover of a fingerprint and an eye looking out at you. We're going to have a long discussion with Michael Ratner and you and me when vacation period is behind us. But we did want to inform our audience that Spying on Democracy by Heidi Boghossian is out, and it's available on the internet and in bookstores. And we want to talk a bit about it and alert you to it so you can go out and read it. Heidi, what was it that brought you to write Spying on Democracy?
Well, Michael, as you know, in the National Lawyers Guild, and certainly on Law and Disorder, we've covered over the last several years reports of activists being infiltrated by law enforcement officers, really the kind of monitoring that we haven't seen since the COINTELPRO programs of J. Edgar Hoover and the activism of the 60s and early 70s. And I think that what interested me was how technology interfaced with the spying apparatus and the surveillance programs that are really omnipresent in all of our lives.
I mean, is it true that what some people are saying, particularly Snowden, that they know everything about us, who we talk to, who we write, who we reach on the internet, who we talk to on the phone? I mean, how pervasive is it?
It's all pervasive, and I think even recent reports that have come out since the initial Snowden revelations are showing the greater extent of the data collection that occurs. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they know exactly what Michael Smith is writing in emails, although they certainly have the capacity to do that. But they're amassing and storing such hordes of metadata that they had to build a new center in Utah with huge computers to store it all. The danger, of course, being that it's then available for future use if a new crisis or fear on the part of the government arises that they want to retroactively target you for.
How does this impact those of us who are involved in the movements for social justice?
It clearly has what we call a chilling effect, especially on lawyers who may wish to communicate either as the Center for Constitutional Rights or the Lawyers Guild or you or any independent practitioner who wants to have email or telephonic communication with a client who may be deemed unpopular by the government. And what it means is that you can never trust that your communications are not being listened in on. So that alters the content of what you say. And as in the case with the center, it means they have to travel abroad or conduct communications in writing, really making the relationship a more difficult one to keep alive.
The subtitle of your new book, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. Talk to me for a moment about corporate power.
We know that 70% of the government's intelligence operations are conducted by private business. They have a very codependent relationship in which Boeing, a lot of other military operations develop equipment specifically designed to conduct surveillance. And the U.S. government actually depends on them for analysis of the data that's gathered and even for setting up the internal communication systems, for example, at the Pentagon. So it behooves business, it helps their bottom line to create more sophisticated and intricate technology that the government depends on You must also realize that business is immune from constitutional stricture, so that they can in many ways spy free from liability. And the government has given the telecommunications industry immunity from lawsuits. So it really shows the extent that not only do we give them latitude, but President Obama has a panel of corporate CEOs who advise him on policy.
Heidi Boghossian, you've written Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. It's been out now in the bookstores for a couple of weeks, and you've been out on the airwaves also. What kind of reaction are you getting from people?
Very positive reactions. A nice book review here and there, and hopefully it will continue to be read. I'd like to thank Edward Snowden for his coming forward, because it certainly made the book timely.
I think we should send one over to Moscow for him. You can endorse it. Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance by our own Heidi Boghossian. Has a foreword by Lewis Latham. It's published by City Lights Books. A wonderful book, a really important book. We urge you to go out and get it. And we promise you that 3 weeks from now, we're going to have a special program on Law and Disorder on Heidi's new book, Spying on Democracy. Thanks, Heidi, for doing this.
Thank you.
Current Israeli-Palestinian peace talks related to the crisis erupting across the Middle East. American armed support for one side in the Syrian civil war and American support for the coup in Egypt both reflect U.S. strategic interests in the area. Now the U.S.-led effort to restart the 22-year-old peace talks between Israel and Palestine has again raised suspicion that the United States is intervening only to benefit Israel. Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel and former Deputy Research Director of AIPAC, the pro-Israeli lobby, Martin Indyk, is the U.S. envoy in the negotiations. The new peace talks, according to our guest Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, will not end the occupation or the siege of Gaza or the decades of dispossession and exile of the Palestinians. She joins us today to give us an overview of the talks as they unfold. Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Phyllis, the current round of Israel-Palestine peace talks are going on now, but really the problem goes all the way back to 1948 and 1967, and I wondered if you could tell us in a nutshell what happened in both of those years and how it's set up the problem that the peace talks are supposed to address today.
Well, you know, Michael, it really goes back before 1948. 1947 was the moment when the British sort of threw up their hands and said, we don't want to be the official colonial power in historic Palestine anymore, so we're going to turn it over to the UN. And the UN did a bunch of discussions and meetings, and at the end of the day, the end of November of 1947, the UN voted to divide Palestine and make two states. And it started out incredibly unfair, because what they decided to do was to give 55% of the land to become a, quote, Jewish state. But that was a time when Jews were amounted to only 30% of the population. So it was already way unfair. The Palestinians, who were 70% of the population, were supposed to get what was to become a state in only 45%. So not surprisingly, there wasn't a lot of support for it among Palestinians. But the partition agreement was signed, and the war that broke out, which was as much against the British as it was between the Palestinians and the what would become the Israelis, but were at the time the Zionist militias before there was a state of Israel. The war led to the expulsion, many at gunpoint, many forcibly, others out of fear, of 750,000 Palestinians who were driven into exile, driven off their land, out of their homes. And at the end of the war, the Palestinians were left with only 22%, not even the 45% they were supposed to have. And the Israelis controlled 78% of historic Palestine and all of Western Jerusalem. Jerusalem was supposed to be separate. It was supposed to be what in international law was called a corpus separatum, a separate body that was to be governed internationally and not controlled by either of these two states. That's what led to the period between 1948 up to 1967, Jordan sort of took over administering the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and Egypt took over administering the Gaza Strip, though neither of them tried to actually make those territories, part of their own country.
So it gets even worse, though, doesn't it? Because if the natives were left with only 22% of historic Palestine in 1948, by 1967 it got even worse. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. 1967, the war breaks out, what became known as the Six-Day War. The Egyptian Air Force, specifically, is the first target of the Israeli military. And the Israeli military, by this time, was really good. They had gotten their arms mainly from France and Czechoslovakia. It's interesting because in that period, between 48 and 67, the U.S. supported Israel, but it wasn't the kind of special relationship that we see now. It was a more normal relationship. Israel wasn't dependent on the U.S. for either lots of economic aid or all its weapons like it is now. It was a very different situation. And at that time, it was the capacity of the Israeli military to take out both the Egyptian and then the Syrian air force. And basically, as the mythology went, they trumped six Arab armies. And that's not really true. Only two of the six actually fought. But whatever you think, they did a pretty good job militarily. And at the end of 6 days, they now controlled 100% of historic Palestine. They now were occupying what had been left to the Palestinians after 48, which meant the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, all were, as well as Egypt's Sinai Peninsula and the Syrian Golan Heights. All were now occupied by Israel. Other than the Sinai, all are still occupied by Israel. So that's what brings us up to the current moment. I mean, we can look back at this particular process, goes back at least 22 years, back to the Madrid Conference of 1991. You know, it's so funny to think about. I was at Madrid. I was really young. The diplomats were really young.
You still are.
Thanks. I like to think so, but it doesn't work that way. Bibi Netanyahu was the spokesman at the time for the Israeli delegation. I went head-to-head with him at this press conference in Madrid, sort of by chance, just because he didn't like the question I asked. You know, that was the beginning of this process that led to the Oslo process, and that led to what we have now, the latest iteration. You know, we've had the roadmap, we've had the Annapolis meetings, we had the Why River Accord. That was my personal favorite because I got to call it the Why Bother Accord, of course. But what we now have is essentially the Einstein version of the peace process, because this is like a perfect example of Einstein's definition of insanity. Do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result.
Can you explain when the shift occurred that the U.S. started giving military aid and how that happened?
Well, you know, that goes back exactly, Heidi, to 1967. It started with the Pentagon looking at what the Israeli military had just done, trouncing six Arab armies, right? And remember, this is 1967. It's the middle of the Cold War. The U.S. is desperate for allies they can rely on against the Soviet Union, against the anti-colonial movements that are springing up across Africa and across the Middle East and everywhere else. And here's Israel having just trounced six Arab armies. And the Pentagon looked at that and said, you know, we could do business with these people. And business becomes the operative word. So the Pentagon starts to build this relationship with the Israeli military that soon expands beyond direct, you know, joint training and that sort of thing to include joint production of weapons, joint development, joint research. And soon you have the beginning of a real interlocking connection between the U.S. and the Israeli military, military producers, war profiteers, military corporations. And that gives rise to a whole new level of influence for the long-standing pro-Israel lobby. Now, the lobby had been around way before 67, but they never really had that much influence. They were, you know, they were one of many foreign policy lobbies, but nobody paid all that much attention to them. Suddenly, 67 comes along, and there's this whole new strategic relationship between Israel and the United States at the level of military, intelligence, all of that stuff. And so there's that trajectory is going full speed. So suddenly the lobby starts to look really powerful because they're claiming it's all because of them. It's like if you get behind a car as it starts to move and you're pushing on the car, you can kind of claim, hey, look at me, I'm pushing this car. It's 50 miles an hour. despite the fact that the car is going on its own 50 miles an hour. So that's what started to happen. Then over the years, since 1967, you have, throughout the years of the Cold War, this tightening of the interlocking connections between the lobby, the political influence, and the military, the strategic influence. And those two get really bound up in each other. So I always thought it was kind of silly when we would have these debates about what's the tail and what's the dog, you know, which is more important, the lobby or the strategic connection. What was important was the connection between them. So then at the end of the Cold War, when the value of Israel to the U.S., you know, Israel becomes kind of a cat's paw for U.S. interventions, not only in the Middle East, but as far afield as Angola and Mozambique and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Chile and South Africa, you know, all around during the Cold War, these hot wars that were the proxy wars between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, Israel plays a big part in a lot of them. And that becomes the major way that, that we see that relationship taking shape. But then when the Cold War ends, you know, the wall comes down in 89, the Soviet Union is over by 1991, in that period, all of a sudden the value of Israel starts to kind of look like it's not such a great asset anymore, that maybe it's even becoming kind of a liability. And that's when you see some changes in U.S. policy. You see George Bush the First make a small move towards holding Israel accountable for its violations of international law on the settlements, for instance, saying that we're not going to give you access to this $10 billion loan guarantee as long as the settlements are in place. It doesn't last long. It was a gesture. It didn't work at the end of the day. But it gave the idea that it would be possible to challenge Israeli policy in a more serious way. But then you have 9/11 and the emergence of the so-called global war on terror, and all of a sudden Israel is a great strategic ally once again. It's an asset again. It's not a liability anymore. So you go back to that special relationship, which is still where we are today.
Talking about what's happening now with Secretary of State John Kerry, how does international law enter into what's on the table in terms of the Middle East negotiations?
Well, funny you should ask that, Heidi, because what I would say is that the biggest gap in this new iteration of peace talks, the so-called peace process, this 22-year-long failed diplomacy that has become an industry all its own, what's historically been missing has been international law, human rights, equality, all the things that we like to think U.S. foreign policy take seriously. The talks are basically the same talks that we've seen before. There was a moment when Secretary of State Kerry seemed to be indicating the possibility of a new initiative because he said it was going to be based on the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative. Now, that was a kind of interesting initiative that came from the Arab states, not from the Palestinians. And it was rejected by Israel right away and ignored by the U.S. And so it kind of died on the vine, as it were. Nobody really took it very seriously. But it had some interesting components. What it basically said was that the Arab states that have, you know, refused to recognize Israel, et cetera, for all these years, claiming it's because of Palestine, when we can argue about what it's really about, but that they would have full normalization with Israel in terms of trade, tourism, diplomatic recognition, all those things, in response to a full Israeli withdrawal, that was the term that was used, full, a full Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, and a just solution to the refugee crisis that, remember, began back in 1947 and 48, based on UN Resolution 194 that guarantees Palestinian refugees the right to return and compensation. It's sometimes misstated that it's the choice of return or compensation, but it's not. 194 guarantees both. So that would have been a kind of interesting beginning for a peace process. But what Kerry said completely undermined that potential, because what he did was to get the Arab League, which is right now a shell of its former self, only about half of its member states actually participate, those that are tied to the U.S. essentially. And the Arab League agreed with his proposal to change the language so that instead of saying there would be normalization in return for a full withdrawal, It said a full withdrawal to the 67 borders with agreed land swaps. This idea of land swaps is the code word that the U.S. and Israel have been using for about the last 7 or 8 years that is based on the idea that Israel will keep all its major settlement blocks, about 80% of the current 600,000+ illegal Israeli settlers that are living in illegal Jews-only settlements in the occupied West Bank and the occupied East Jerusalem. About 80% of the settlers would stay. All the major settlement blocks, which are city-sized settlements, I mean, they're cities. They're not, you know, a few tents and hardy pioneers on the hilltop. These are cities of 40, 50,000 people with shopping centers and swimming pools and colleges and industrial zones with industrial waste going down the hill into the Palestinian villages at the bottom. Israel will keep all of those. Israel will keep all the major water aquifers of the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And they will call that land swaps because in return they will give Palestine few acres of desert land abutting Gaza or some other land that's not developed, you know, and call that an equal swap. Mm-hmm. So this is a recipe for failure. You know, it's not to say that no Palestinian leader would ever accept it. Some Palestinian leaders might. Mahmoud Abbas might be one of them. But if they did, it would not answer the needs of Palestinians, either the refugees, who are not even being mentioned right now in these talks, or the Palestinians living in the occupied territories. It won't be accepted, which means there won't be a, quote, end of the conflict, which is the Israeli goal here. Something reflected by Secretary Kerry, unfortunately, in his statement. He said, let's be clear what the U.S. goal is. It's to end the conflict, not to end the occupation, not to end the dispossession, not to end the oppression. It's to end the conflict, which means ending the resistance to occupation and dispossession and oppression. They would just stop disagreeing. Everybody would be happy.
If the Palestinians reject any of these proposals, they're going to be perhaps more vilified for blocking the process.
Absolutely. This will go back to the model that was set by President Clinton back in 2000, when one of his promises to the two sides at the Camp David talks, that version of the failed talks, was that he promised that if the talks failed, he would not blame either side. Well, that lasted about an hour. After the talks failed, he came out and told the press it was the Palestinians' fault. And to this day, you know, I speak all over the country on this. One of the most common questions I get, both in hostile ways and open-minded, curious ways, is why did Arafat reject Barak's generous offer? And the answer always has to start with, it wasn't a generous offer.
Right.
But it's understandable why people ask that question, because that's what we were told. That helped the demonization of the Palestinian side.
In conclusion, it looks like what the Israelis want is what they already have. They're not going to give up very much at all. They'll keep the water. They'll keep the land. It looks like they want East Jerusalem, which was supposed to be an international city, and they just want the Arabs to stop protesting.
Resisting. Exactly.
But our question now is, well, what can we do? Where do we go from here? What can people listening to this show do to support justice for the Palestinians?
You know, I think the one bit of optimism that I see on the Israel-Palestine front, there's not a lot, and none of it comes from the diplomatic side, frankly. Where I do see some optimism is the extraordinary level of civil society mobilization, both inside the occupied territories, where you still see this extraordinary, the word in Arabic, samud, which means something like steadfastness, something like that. The ability of people to withstand these decades now of occupation, generations of occupation and dispossession, and continue to resist. They resist by continuing to get an education. They resist by the weekly protests against the wall, by continuing to take Israeli developers to court when they build new settlements, all of those things. But also the global civil society movement, including here in the U.S., the coalition, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which began with 15 or so nervous activists representing 5 or 6 small organizations, and is now over 400 organizations across the country, from giant church-based organizations, Jewish anti-occupation organizations, and everything else. You know, there's trade union groups, there's black community organizations, peace groups, all part of this huge coalition that are trying to change U.S. policy on this issue. And what we've seen is an extraordinary shift in the discourse. So the campaign that's known as BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, that is aimed at forcing Israel to stop its violations of international law. And if it doesn't, that there should be consequences that we as civil society can bring. We can stop buying settlement-produced goods. In Europe, the BDS movement has pressured enough countries that the European Union has now issued new guidelines calling for an end to any European Union funding of institutions or individuals in the occupied territories. It's a huge, very important symbolically. The amount of money isn't so big, but symbolically it's enormous, and the Israelis recognize that. There's been huge pushback from inside Israel. The campaigns here in the U.S. against the $30 billion in military aid to Israel that we are committed to over this 10 years, President Obama has said he wants to raise that to something close to $40 billion over the next 10 years. The challenge to that has been greater than we've ever seen before. A few brave members of Congress have even begun to talk about this issue differently. So I think that that's where we see the real shift. The real pressure on Israel is not coming, unfortunately, from U.S. diplomacy, where it should be coming from. It should be saying that the diplomacy from now on is going to be based on international law. And Israel, if you continue to build settlements in violation of international law, you continue the siege of Gaza in violation of international law, that's fine, you can do what you want, but that's $30 billion, you can kiss that goodbye. And our protection of Israeli officials, both military and political, at the UN, so you're never held accountable in the International Criminal Court, for example, we're not doing that anymore. That's what real diplomacy would begin to look like. We're not seeing that, so we're doing that ourselves as civil society. And I would urge the listeners to contact the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. The website is endtheoccupation.org. Find an organization that's a member group of the campaign in your local area, a campus group, a community group, and get involved. That's where the fun is. That's where the work is. That's where the great optimism is coming from.
Phyllis, in our last couple of minutes, I wanted to just segue from what you just mentioned about campuses, because we've talked on Law and Disorder with a lot of law professors and Palestinian students who have been punished for speaking out over the last few years. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a change at all? Is it becoming less dangerous in a way to speak out on campus?
You know, I think it is less dangerous everywhere, on campus, in communities. I don't get death threats anymore, you know. I see it on a bunch of different levels. What is true is that pro-Israel activists of various sorts are feeling desperate. They're feeling the pressure. And when people and organizations get desperate, they lash out. So it's not surprising that we're seeing some pretty high-profile efforts to shut down pro-Palestinian voices, but particularly voices that are focused on international law. You know, this isn't about, we stand in solidarity with the heroic people of Palestine against the terrible people of Israel. This is about, we stand for international law, human rights, and equality. And anybody who violates international law should be held accountable. That's a hard thing to challenge. So you see the challenge coming with a lot of name-calling, a lot of pretty ugly incidents. But I think the reason is there's no longer a good, if there ever was, we can argue about that, you know, over coffee some night, but the reality is there is no real argument to be made at this point that can defend Israel's practices. And so those who want to defend Israel, regardless of their actual practice in the real world, are forced to resort to what amounts to name-calling rather than serious engagement and disagreement. That, you know, if people want to say, no, international law shouldn't apply, all right, let's argue that. That's a real issue. But let's not reduce it to, if you say that Israel is committing a war crime, you're anti-Semitic. That's simply name-calling. That's not grounded in law. That's not grounded in politics.
I wanted to ask you one last question, a personal question, if I might.
Oh, dear.
You've been involved in the issues for justice for Palestinians in the Middle East for much of your adult life. And my question is, you know, why so committed? Why such an involvement?
You know, I think everybody gets involved in an issue that they feel passionate about. I grew up a very active, passionate Zionist. And when I finally started studying what U.S. policy had always been about, studying the war, and that was all because of Vietnam. It wasn't because of what I learned in Zionist youth group, for instance. It was about what I found when I went to college in the last few years of the war in Vietnam and suddenly was faced with a huge global movement challenging this U.S. war across the world. And I started studying imperialism and studying what U.S. policy was all about and studying what colonialism meant. And I remember thinking to myself one day, you know, I think I was wrong about that Israel stuff. And I went to my father's library and I read Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism. I read his diary where he wrote letters to Cecil Rhodes, the best known of the great, quote, British explorers and colonialists. He wrote to Cecil Rhodes begging him to come on board his project of Zionism. And he wrote, you know, I know that your interest is Africa. This was the same Cecil Rhodes who ultimately claimed and named the country Zimbabwe, that's now Zimbabwe, as Rhodesia. And he wrote to Rhodes and said, I know that your interest is Africa and mine is Arabia, but what we share is an interest in colonialism. These are colonial projects and we should work together. And when I saw the founder of modern Zionism calling his own work the work of colonialism, I thought, boy, I was wrong about that stuff. I think I better learn some about the other side.
Phyllis Bennis, thank you very much for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you, guys. It's always a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Longtime environmental and labor activist Marie Mason continues to serve out a harsh 22-year prison sentence based on her involvement in two acts of property damage and arson. Mason is serving the longest sentence of any convicted animal rights or environmental activist. In one of the incidents, Mason and her husband Ambrose set fire to a Michigan State University building, targeting a Monsanto-funded office in charge of a genetically modified crop research program to create moth-resistant crops for Africa. Marie was later set up by her husband, who recorded their conversation, gave it to the feds, that led to her conviction. We're joined today by Detroit-based talk radio host Peter Werby, who has followed Marie Mason's case since its inception. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Peter.
Well, thank you very much, Heidi.
Well, we haven't talked much on this show about Marie Mason, but it's an important case and one that you've taken a clear interest in since its inception. Can you give us a brief summary of what her case is about and how you got involved?
Sure. Marie Mason was an environmental activist from the Detroit area, although she's lived in different places around the country. And in late 1999 and in early 2000, actually very early, January 1st, she committed a number of acts the government considered illegal. They were eco-sabotage, frustrated by her lack of ability of her and others to mobilize great numbers of people to defend the environment. Against things like genetically modified organisms, she and her husband at the time entered a research lab at Michigan State University and set fire to these records, you know, arson under the laws. And she also damaged logging equipment in an area where they were doing clear cutting. without being challenged, these are a fait accompli. I mean, when you get these Frankenstein genes into the environment, there's no longer any debate. When you clear cut an old growth forest, that's the end of debate as well. She was desperate. She actually escaped apprehension until her husband, who became estranged from her, was caught in another matter and, as we say in street parlance, ratted her out in 2007. And she was brought to trial. He actually wore a wire taping her and going around the country and making 140 other recordings of environmental activists, but was only able to ensnare her. She was tried for these acts in federal court because I believe because there was involved in federal funding in some of the research that she was about destroying, and was found guilty. And actually, she pled guilty. She pled guilty. They told her that they would go for life imprisonment if she didn't plead guilty. And the prosecution, this was the plea deal, asked for 15 to 20 years. That was the deal. The judge ignored that and gave her 22 years in prison under these federal terrorism
enhancements. Right.
Yeah. And so she now is the longest serving prisoner of this nature in the country. No one was ever injured in any of these. If I could just say quickly, by contrast, in Detroit, there was a man who set fire to a building in order to gain insurance. He wound up with a plea bargain for 7 years in prison, even though four firemen were injured. There was a documentary about Detroit firemen called Burn. They're featured in there, including one who's paralyzed for life. So if you do that for profit, you get 7 years. If you're trying to defend the environment, even if one would think it's misguided, you get 22.
She's got two children, doesn't she?
She has two grown children, yes.
It's clear in this case that the government was trying to make an example of Marie. A few years before her sentence, the FBI called environmental and animal rights activists a top domestic terrorism threat. And in many ways, her profile, much like Lynn Stewart, you know, former school teacher, older lawyer, Marie Mason, not your typical radical activist, sends a frightening message when you put someone like that away for so many years.
Indeed, because, for instance, there are all these Catholic peace activists who regularly go down to Tennessee to protest against nuclear facilities there. And previously, they were convicted under misdemeanors. They are now, some of them are facing 15 years in prison on federal charges. So this has ramped up, besides just the injustice of the individual case of Marie Mason, it also affects all activists that the government is involved in a real counterterrorism campaign by giving people outrageous sentences, you know, that do not fit the crime.
What's the legal status of her case now?
She appealed the sentence, saying that it was disproportionate to other federal guidelines for sentencing. Unfortunately, the right-wing Bush-appointed judge wrote the sentencing guidelines, so she didn't get anywhere with the Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. And we thought that was at an end. She was sent to a federal women's facility in Waseca, Minnesota, where she did good work. She taught guitar. She was a model prisoner, if you will. But one day, about 2.5 years ago now, she was in the middle of the night. She was taken to administrative segregation, the hole, held there for a couple of months, and suddenly in the middle of the night, in chains, taken in a small plane and took off. She said she thought she was going to Guantanamo or something like that. She wound up in the special administrative unit of Carswell Federal Medical Center. Lynn Stewart is in Carswell, but she's in the general population. Women are sent there with medical difficulties, but it's a horror show. If anybody just Googles Carswell medical complaints, I mean, it's astounding. Marie Mason, who's had medical problems in the past, she's 52 years old. She now has just gotten on a list to be on a list to see a doctor. I mean, this is astounding. Oh, and she was told that she was moved because she was recruiting for the Earth Liberation Front, that she maintained a connection via email that was provided by the prison to radical environmentalists. There was no hearing. There was no charge. They just kept saying that she was moved administratively. This administrative unit is a gymnasium size unit where women who have histories of violence, some political prisoners are there. I think you know of, and you may have discussed the case of Afia Siddiqui, the Pakistani national.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a horror show. Every time I call her, she calls me. You can hear people screaming. She says, "Peter, we're going on lockdown right now. There's women involved in self mutilation." She hears screams and sobs through, you know, out the night. Here's this environmentalist who loves nature, and her feet have touched nothing but concrete for the last 3 years. And she hasn't seen the sky except through wire mesh.
Well, Peter, we also know in the case of Daniel McGowan, who did get out of prison a few months ago, he was in a CMU for a while, allegedly because he was politically active in a similar fashion as with Marie. They always want to say you can't have contact with outsiders lest you organize or, you know, inspire others to get involved politically.
Mm-hmm. Now, she is given full email access, full postal mail access. What we think is that they are using those communications. It's a different kind of communications management. They're not trying to restrict her communications. They want to see who is writing her and creating, I'm sure, this huge chart.
Yes.
Of who's in touch with her. Because Marie Mason's support is it actually has startled me to the extent of it. It is worldwide. On her birthday on January 26th and also on June 11th, this International Day of Solidarity with her, there are actions and letter writing campaigns and what have you across the world, in New Zealand, in Israel, in Europe, in all across the United States. It's quite astounding.
Is there a website, something that we can—
Well, there's a website that has all the information on it, and it's very simple. It's what we call for, too. It's supportmariemason.org, supportmariemason.org, or you could even just Google the name.
You've been involved in the case, reported on it since her arrest?
Yes. I'm being personal friends with her for 25 years in many ways is the key motivator originally, although I certainly would, you know, support her even if I didn't know her because of the injustice. She has written extensively for the Fifth Estate magazine, which I also work with, and one of those old underground papers from the 1960s. It's
great paper, the Fifth Estate.
In fact, it's the last one.
Right, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, so it's partly, you know, friendship, but also, it's the injustice of it all. And being involved with her case, I mean, I was always aware of, you know, real prominent things like that of Lynn Stewart and others. But you realize that just off the margins a little of the prisoner support networks, there's all these people that are suffering the kind of things that that Marie is. And this unit that Marie is in, I mean, I understand that there's problem prisoners, and that's where the women problem prisoners are. Marie is not a problem at all. She's never had a disciplinary infraction. But nobody should be subjected to what prisoners are in that unit, just like, you know, so many other administrative units around the country. But right now we have a campaign going to try to move her out of there, and we're trying to enlist as many people to write the Bureau of Prisons director, who is the guy that countermanded. I didn't realize that. Apparently, the warden of Carswell said okay to Lynn Stewart's release, and the Bureau of Prisons director, right, Samuels, said, uh-uh. So that's who we're appealing to.
Samuels actually said she's improving.
Yeah, right.
There was a hearing last week in federal court here in Manhattan in front of the sentencing judge to determine on what medical basis the guy made that bizarre judgment. But nonetheless, how do we contact Marie? What do we do to support her?
It's all at the website. I can give you the address, but those addresses, as I found doing radio myself, being a radio broadcaster who just interviewed Heidi, I should say. let me give just a quick self-promotion. You can hear that at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Is that giving numbers and all that on the radio doesn't work. It's all right there at supportmariemason.org. There's publicity materials available. There's how you can donate. Marie's address. And Marie can receive mail from anyone, although she cannot always answer everybody. I think she's at her limit of 100 prisoners. So they're very, like I said, the feds are very anxious to see who she's in contact with. So people should think of that. If people are going to act out of fear, they've already won. Right now, writing Marie is not going to hurt.
Well, I can promise you, Peter, that Heidi and I and our producer, Jeff Brady, will write Marie by tomorrow.
Okay. I wrote her and told her I was going to be on this program, so she'll certainly appreciate that.
So an appeal has been filed?
No. Right now, I think a fellow attorney in New York City, who I think you both know, Susan Tippograph, is filing some FOIA request to find out what was the basis of her being transferred out of this minimum or medium security prison into this cement hellhole that Marie Mason is now in. So there are legal maneuvers, but we have not done anything in terms of legal challenges. Right now, there's nothing being done to challenge her sentence, and I suspect, I'm not an attorney, but I suspect at this point there's nothing that can be done.
Well, that's when we rely on the People's Movement, raising our voices as strongly as we can.
Absolutely.
SupportMarieMason.org. Peter Werbe, it's a pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder. Thank
yes,
you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to both of you.
We go now to a speech given by Dr. Harriet Fraud, a psychotherapist in New York City, at the June 9th Left Forum panel. Dr. Fraud's speech is about what personal relations would be like in America if we weren't living under a capitalist system. Fraud is a practicing psychotherapist in New York City and a longtime activist in progressive social movements. Let's have a listen.
Hi, I'll try to be brief. I thought I had mine and Tess's slots. I don't. Anyhow, let's imagine what America would like if success were measured by the efficiency in producing kindness to each other rather than the efficiency in producing more profits for the boss, CEO, board of directors. Imagine what relationships would be like if connections between people were celebrated as much as wealth and the additional accumulation of more and more wealth. Within the capitalist system, there's no point in even hiring anyone unless you're making more for their work than you're giving them in salary. The employer gains by denying employees the full value of their work. That is considered good business. Kindness is not rewarded. Thus, the clever business school graduate may be highly paid for inventing those gimmicks that disguise hidden charges in our phone bills, that add charges for banking operations or interest charges on credit card accounts. Think of the rich prize for that clever business grad who thought of putting the minimum payment on the credit card bill as if it were the actual amount that needed to be paid, which leaves the balance as an opportunity for the creditor to charge exorbitant interest. A clever business person will be richly rewarded for thinking up such dubious financial instruments as credit default swaps or mortgage-backed securities that bring economic misery, lack of accountability, and homelessness. That clever business person is thought of as ingenious rather than sneaky and dishonest. What does it do to human relationships to spend our work days denying ourselves and others what our work is really worth and robbing our chances to decide what we're going to produce, how we're going to produce it, and what we're going to do with the profit. What would it feel like to work for each other and ourselves rather than to profit rich owners or the state, which benefits them primarily? What kind of effect does that basically unethical arrangement have on our behavior when we leave our jobs? What does it do to our relationships with each other? Imagine how it would feel if we weren't cheated or cheating other people of the full value of our work. Imagine feeling safe. At present, the U.S. is considered efficient to lay people off and give little or no security to new workers. Precarity defines the workplaces of almost all of us. Precarious work refers to all possible shapes of unsure, non-guaranteed labor. The 8-hour day that so many Americans fought and died for is mostly history. Precarity means that you work when you profit them greatly or you lose your job. Most American workers don't know how or when we could be laid off. It casts its shadow across our hope and our plans for the future. Profits are maintained. Precarity and its Siamese twins, insecurity and fear, reign. Imagine the luxury of time. European nations have 4 to 6 weeks of guaranteed paid vacation. They get extra time off if they're sick so that their vacations won't be spent recuperating. Imagine knowing you and your friends and family could have time and space to get to know each other and have the talks that can only happen when you have time to relax. Americans have the least time off of any developed nation, including places that are much poorer than us, like Brazil or Argentina. We also have the highest rates of divorce and the highest rates of child abuse in the world. The strains on people are terrible. Imagine the good feeling of workers running their businesses together cooperatively, as they do in the 85,000-member cooperative that is Mondragon, Spain. When you go to Mondragon, you cannot fail to notice the relaxation of people and also the lack of police presence. They don't need police. They are equals sharing profit. Imagine the mental health benefits, and I as a therapist can attest, if we weren't so afraid of losing everything. In Mondragon, the CEOs are elected. The maximum that they can get, and by the way, Europeans also have maximum wages as well as minimum ones. In America, is exceptional that way. I call that American exceptionalism. Anyway, you can't earn more than 6.5 times the pay of the average worker in your industry. In the United States, the CEO earns on average 400 times the amount that a worker earns in his or her industry. The more unequal a society is, the more likely it is that infant mortality, children's educational performance, social mobility, and trust between people will be lower. This is beautifully documented in an excellent book by Wilson and Pickett called The Spirit Level. Rates of homicide, imprisonment, teen birth rates, mental illness, and addictions increase. These blights wound all Americans. They are the most injurious at the bottom, but they are also injurious at the top. I remember a client of mine who was a teenager getting a big thrill, and she had a cocaine problem, that her teachers at school couldn't afford the coke that she could. In the 1970s, America was the most egalitarian developed nation in the world. Now we are the least egalitarian of all the other developed nations. Imagine knowing that we're all basically equal. No one would need to feel inferior or ashamed because they couldn't live the lives of the, quote, rich and famous. Those people who the mass media celebrate with stories about their glamorous lives, cars, relationships, interests, and so on. Shame is a piercing injury. Imagine mass media full of stories of regular working people celebrating our deeds, our work, our lifestyle, our relationships. Imagine eliminating capitalist profits to our health. Imagine the relief we'd have being taught a healthy lifestyle to protect us from the scourges of such profit, such as obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and asthma. Imagine healthy food being promoted instead of junk food. Imagine affordable working class restaurants with playgrounds as available as McDonald's and serving quality food. Imagine the level of asthma that would go down if pollutants were taken out of our care. Imagine getting sick without worry about money. Imagine knowing that whatever research is behind the medical products we consume, and certainly psych is among them, was not done by the same companies that profited from them, but rather by independent research. Imagine knowing that our caregivers weren't paid extra for prescribing known drugs with side effects or medical devices. Imagine them not getting kickbacks. Imagine that when we're sick, we go to a doctor who knows us, who takes the time, who can imagine how and why we got sick and help. Cuba's poor, but they have 23 times less that they have to pay in healthcare costs, and their infant mortality rates are lower. We have the costliest medical system in the world that provides inferior care. The supports that hold us up psychologically, because I'm talking about relationships and personal life, are like a four-legged chair. One leg is personal life with an intimate circle that may be a partner and others, deep friends, children, or family. A second leg of our mental health is a wider circle of people who provide a set of connections around a shared interest or activity. Could be a PTA, could be a blood drive, could be a political party. It could be a church. A third leg of our mental health seat is a sense of hope and security, which this book is trying to build, thanks to Francis and Michael and Debbie Smith. A sense of hope and security built on opportunities for a secure livelihood, chances to improve one's own life, and hope for the future. A fourth leg supporting us is a sense of hope and security that comes when we basically trust each other. The United States is the highest on the distrust indices of all the developed nations.
That was Dr. Harriet Fraud speaking at the June 9th Left Forum.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.